Welcome to the Heal, Thrive, Dream podcast, where trauma survivors become healthy thrivers. Each month, we'll feature a theme in the trauma recovery and empowerment field to promote your recovery, healing, and learning how to build dreams. Here's your host, Karen Robinson, transformational coach and therapist.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Heal, Thrive, Dream podcast. Today, my guest is Sandy Phillips Kirkham. Sandy and her husband enjoy life with their two grown children, two beautiful granddaughters, and two fairly well-behaved dogs. They reside in Cincinnati, Ohio. After experiencing clergy sexual abuse at age 16 by her youth pastor and remaining silent for 27 years, she now uses her voice to advocate for victims and changes in the church. She has spoken before the Ohio Senate and a Maryland court. She serves on the board of COCA, which is Council on Child Abuse, is a spokesperson for the Hope of Survivors Ministry. She works with survivors conducting victim support conferences. She tells her story in her book, Let Me Pray Upon You, which, you know, welcome, first of all, Sandy, before I say anything else.
Good to be here.
Thank you for being here. Yes. I wanted to tell you that, and excitement is not a great word for this, but I was thrilled to receive your book when you sent it to me. I already knew the title, Let Me Pray, P-R-E-Y, upon you, but the cover was also very symbolic with, for those of you on the podcast, you can't see, but on YouTube, it has pictures. Okay, it's hard to see with the Zoom background, but it has a picture of a wolf and some sheep. So I thought that was very, very moving for, you know, for Christians, especially to see, because it's significant. So thank you for writing that book. I know it's probably not the easiest thing you've ever done in your life. So thank you for doing that. So what about your bio did I miss that you think would be super helpful for our audience to know you a little better?
Well, that pretty much covers it, other than the fact that I was very active in the church as a young girl, and being sexually abused by my youth pastor was absolutely devastating to me. It's important, I think, to understand how involved I really was in the church and what it meant to me.
Yes. As a reader, and I have not finished the book yet, but as a reader, that definitely comes out loud and clear. Like, you were... And I think the importance of your family background too, like having your parents divorce at a time where divorce wasn't happened super frequently, and how you felt about that.
The church became a safe haven for me. Yeah. And I looked to the pastor as like a father figure. And so he tapped into that and used that as a way to get to me.
Yeah. And there were other vulnerabilities in the family. You know, one, not getting to see your dad as often. And then your stepfather was a bit on the controlling side. So not necessarily a safe place for you in order to talk and open up to him.
Right.
And your mom, I'm guessing, was a bit overwhelmed with all the kiddos that she had, you know, after getting remarried. And then I noticed another vulnerability. I think you may not think is significant. I don't know what you think. I'm going to ask you, but I felt as a clinician was significant was, your grandfather completing suicide.
Right, right.
Yeah, yes. So that meant there was at least a paternal history of some depression.
Yes.
I think you said he had a more serious mental illness.
I think he was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Yeah. And were you close to him? Did you have a relationship with him at all?
Well, I saw him a lot. They lived next door to us. He kind of always scared me a little bit because it was the way he acted sometimes. And now I can look back and see why. He was a kind person. He was never mean to me, but he was scary to me in a little bit of a ways. And when he would drink, he could become violent. And I did see some of that at times. And being as young as I was, it certainly did have an effect on me, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I thought that was significant to point out, because you had some vulnerabilities. And of course, what do we know about groomers? They look for people with vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And,
exactly.
And because of their role, we doubt ourselves, like, well, of course I should. I saw this over and over in your book at the beginning. Of course I should trust.
There's never any reason to question someone who that you have known or you know, and someone who seems to be caring about you, someone who seems to want to help you. They're the pastor or the priest or the rabbi of the church and synagogue. So they're looked up to, and mm-hmm. we're taught not to question them. But again, groomers look like, as you said, for vulnerabilities, and then they exploit those vulnerabilities. They appear to be helping you in the beginning only as a way to get to you, to establish a false relationship that you trust them so much that when they do cross the boundaries, you're confused and you have somewhat of a caring about them that you don't want to accuse them of doing something they shouldn't be doing.
Right. Yeah, because at that point, they're one of the closest people that you have. They're a confidant.
Yes.
And I noticed when you were upset with your family, I think your stepdad, how he treated a guest you had in your home, mm-hmm. you went to him and he was there for you.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the abuse, you know, it starts so subtly because it began really as just a kiss. It happened after a youth group meeting. He waited for everyone to be alone and he told me how wonderful I was and how much I was helping the church. And of course, I'm elated and feeling very special. And I was shocked, but I tried to justify it because this was the pastor and he wouldn't be doing anything he shouldn't be doing. But over a year's time, the grooming continued. The kissing became a little more passionate. The hugs lasted longer till eventually, a little bit over a year, he had sex with me. And then that's when the abuse really took off as far as he became demanding, controlling, became violent, hit me. He totally changed in his personality. And so I felt like I was in a black hole with no way out. And of course, as abusers do, I was told, you know, this was between the two of us. I couldn't tell anyone, no one would believe me. And I also knew if I were to expose him to the church, this would be a bombshell. People loved him. He was beloved in the church. And so I just didn't know what to do. And so I just accepted that this was going to be what I needed to do until he said it was over. And the abuse went on for 5 years.
One of the key phrases that you use to describe his personality, I think, is super important. And it was charismatic.
Mm-hmm. Very.
Yeah. So people think that charismatic leaders are the be all end all, right? Like they're mm-hmm. so full of life and helpful and there for people when needed and have all this energy.
He was treated like a rock star by the members of the church. And he did some wonderful things in the church. I mean, he did transform the church. I mean, that's what charismatic leaders do. And so as I tell people, he not only grooms a victim, but he also grooms an entire congregation. He's also manipulating them as well, because if and when he's caught, he needs his tribe around him to support him. And that is exactly what happened. In my case, he was caught and he was given a going away party and given accolades and moved to the next church. Eventually I was called in by the elders and told that because of my behavior, I was to leave the church, and I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated. I was to blame. And that's what he told me would happen. He always had said to me, if you ever tell anyone, you'll be responsible for what happens to me and you will be blamed.
Yeah. And what was your family's response when it came out? Were they supportive of you?
Well, initially, the elders told me that I was not to tell anyone, including my parents. And of course, I'm in this emotional turmoil of state. I just, you know, he's been caught. I'm assuming I'm just as guilty because, you know, I participated in this. And at that time, I'm 21 years old. And so initially, I wasn't to tell my parents. But as rumors start in most churches, I knew more people were finding out. So I actually begged them to let me tell my parents. So I told my mom and my stepfather. My stepfather was extremely angry. I think wanted to kill him. My mother, on the other hand, wanted it to go away. And so she knew he would be leaving and thought that would end it and didn't want to make it any more than it already was. So that was somewhat her reaction. And as bizarre as this may sound, she liked him. I mean,
Yeah.
I mean, so for her, it was like, let's just let it end and move on, which was her way of coping, I think, with a lot of things in her life. So I don't fault her for that. And they certainly didn't blame me. I wasn't looked at but there wasn't the knowledge in the 70s of abuse. And again, because I was 21 when it ended, I was to tell everyone that it had only been going on a year, which made it seem less obviously less of a crime or, you know, abuse, because I was in my 20s, supposedly, when it happened. And I went along with that because, again, I was, by that point, had been so under his control and had lost myself that I just did what I was told. And then for 27 years, I kept that secret. I never told anyone. I didn't tell my husband. My close friends never knew. And that secret remained with me for 27 years and affected my life for 27 mm-hmm. years. That trauma continued in my life because I was still carrying that secret. I was still carrying the guilt. I was still carrying the idea that this was somehow something I could have stopped and prevented, and I didn't, which isn't true. Right. Victims need to understand that you are not responsible for what was done to you. You were targeted, you were trapped, and you only could deal in the only way you knew how with the coping skills you had at the time. And they didn't allow you to take what you needed to do to stop this person, because, again, they have already looked for ways to target you. They've looked for ways to control you. And you don't have any control in that situation.
Right. And so whatever happened to him, did he get away with this completely?
Well, he moved to the next church where once again, he committed sexual misconduct. He then moved to another church. Our denomination removed him from the denomination. He went to another denomination. Now, of course, you haven't read the entire book, but I'm going to give you a spoiler alert here.
That's okay.
I eventually confronted him 27 years later. When I began my healing process, one of the things that I felt I needed to do, wouldn't recommend it for every victim, but for me, I wanted to confront him. So I hired a private investigator and found him ministering at a church in Alabama. Give you a quick rundown. Basically, I was told this happened 27 years ago. He's a changed man. We don't think there should be any consequences for this. And so move along. This, in spite of the fact, in my meeting with him, he talked about the number of times there had been sexual misconduct. They weren't all teenagers. Some were adult women. And that he had been in therapy and he had been identified as a sexual addict. Now, I don't know in whose world anyone thinks that someone who's been identified as a sexual addict should be in a position of leadership within a church. But this denomination, which is the Disciples of Christ, obviously thinks that's okay. He remained in ministry for the next 10 years or so. I believe he's semi-retired now, but he remains in good standing and he can certainly go out and preach or do anything in a church that he would feel comfortable doing or want to do. So he's still a minister and could preach, I think, on interim basis if he wants to.
Okay. That's disturbing to hear, but I can't say I'm surprised, right? Mm-hmm. After right. working with trauma survivors for as long as I have.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I was really happy to see in the book is you called him out by name. Like from the very beginning, you used his full name.
But let me correct you on that.
No,
I did not. And I'll tell you, there's a couple reasons. And I have been criticized for that. But initially, when I began speaking about my abuse, mm-hmm. I wanted to speak to churches. I wanted to get into churches to say, here's what happened. Here's how you can prevent it. And I did not want to be seen as someone who was doing this out of revenge. I wanted my message to be about me, the trauma, and what I went through and how churches could stop this and prevent it. So I didn't use his name in the beginning when I spoke. And I would go to conferences and I would speak because I didn't want this to look like this was a platform mm-hmm. for revenge. The other reason I didn't use his name is, it's also in the book. I eventually called his wife. And not that I was responsible for what had occurred during that time, but I wanted to acknowledge the pain that she must have been going through at the same time. And so we became very close friends. I also knew his children, and she had asked me not to use his name. And so that was, I felt, my gift to her and to his children not to do that, even though he deserves to be outed. It was my personal choice not to do that.
Are you saying the name in the book is a fake name?
It is. It is.
Okay. Okay. No, my intention was not to judge it. But,
I struggled with that. I did struggle a lot with that because I understand why it's important to name your abuser. I went to his church leaders. I went to the president of the denomination. I went to every minister that was in that region of that church. And I got the same answer. We don't care. It was 27 years ago. We don't want to hear it. And so I felt like I had done all I could to out him within his community. Mm-hmm. And I got nowhere with that. And so again, when I wrote the book, I decided that I would not use his name for the reasons that I just gave.
Yeah. And you really don't have to explain that to anybody.
It's no, I really, I, right. Our journeys are our own. Yeah, yeah. Our healing journeys are our own. And I, it's important that victims understand that no one should tell you that you need to forgive. No one should tell you that you should get over it. No one should say it's been too long. I mean, I've been accused of not being healed because I continue to talk about this. And so each of us have our own journey. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. And why I wanted to bring up that I thought it was his name is, I was wondering about if you had consulting with, because it's risky to use somebody's name for multiple reasons.
My husband is an attorney, but I also consulted another attorney who deals in this kind of thing. And he felt very confident that I could have used his name without any legal ramifications. But again, the reasons I chose were for other reasons anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for telling us about that.
Yeah.
So I always feel when I work with survivors, there's choices.
Right.
And there's pros and cons to all choices. Mm-hmm. So you made the best decision for you.
Right.
Yeah. And he knows who he is.
He does. And a lot of other people know who he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let me see. What else was difficult? Like, I felt like when I was reading too, that he was emotionally abusive. Like he kept you on your toes. Like it was praise, criticism, praise. Is there anything about that you'd like to share?
Yeah, that is a technique that a lot of abusers use. It's the narcissistic, it's to keep you in a yo-yo position. Mm-hmm. I never knew, you know, which person was going to show up. And that was how he controlled me in many ways. And that fear factor that comes in that, you know, I have to do what he says or I'm going to have consequences. And I never knew. And it was part of his method to keep me under his control. And again, this lasted for 5 years. So really the first couple of years, I struggled and tried to get out of the relationship. I would go to him and, you know, say to him, I can't do this anymore. Well, he would respond in one of two ways. One was very loving, very caring, that he needed me in the ministry and that we were married in God's eyes and this was God's will. And he's playing into my religious and spiritual aspect of my life. Or the other way that he responded was to shove me against the wall and tell me that I was no longer a virgin. No one was going to love me, that he was the only one that could love me. And that back and forth was just, and I eventually came to believe that. So at some point, and I would say probably in the 3 years into the relationship, I gave up. I just accepted that this was going to be my life. And I remember so vividly one day sitting down thinking, I'm never going to be married. I'm never going to have children. And this will only be over when he says it's over. And I didn't see that path happening. I didn't see him ever saying that to me. And so I just began not only to accept the relationship, but then, as you'll read in the book, he became much more deviant sexually. And things that I did in my life during that time were things that I can't even imagine that I would have done, but I did because I had given up. I just, whatever he wanted, I was willing to do.
Yeah. You were Stockholm syndromed at that point.
Yes. And there's a trauma bonding that we have with our abusers and the gaslighting. You know, he told me that he was the only one that could love me. And I know it's hard sometimes for people to understand, but just because there's a way out doesn't mean you see that way out. And so I did feel like I was in a black hole with no way out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when this came out, how did your stepfather acted like a father in terms of his reaction, I'm guessing?
Well, he was angry. He, you know, like I said, he wanted to kill him. My mother and I both didn't want to make a scene and make it worse. I, at that point, all I wanted to do was to keep as few people as fine as possible. I was embarrassed. I mean, here I was in my mind having an affair with a married man who was the pastor of my church. I mean, that's how I saw it. So for me, it was not only to protect me, but to protect him as well. And so I didn't want anything more to come out of it than already was. And I knew he was moving at that point. So, and I never told my dad, I didn't see
him.
Yeah. I didn't see him as often. I had a close relationship with him in spite of that, but I didn't want him to be disappointed in me. I didn't want to have to tell him. It was hard enough to tell my mom and my stepfather. It was hard enough that there were people in the church that I cared about and who I thought cared about me now knew, had turned against me. So for me, the fewer people who knew, the better. And that's why, again, for 27 years, I wasn't going to let anybody know about my past. And I remember thinking one day, how do I tell someone that I had an affair with a married man who was my pastor and they kicked me out of the church? I mean, how bad do you have to be kicked out of a church? So I carried all that with me for 27 years.
Yeah. Is that part of you healed?
Oh, yes. It has. My healing journey, I mean, I confronted him in 2004. So it's been 18 years. Not been easy, as many trauma victims will tell you. Healing is messy. You take 4 steps forward and then you take 2 steps back. Mm-hmm. And you have to let go of a lot of the lies and unravel the deceit that was put upon us. The things that he told me, I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't pretty enough. No one was ever else was going to love me. My self-esteem at the end of that 5 years was down to nothing. I had no self-worth. It was like, I deserved whatever came my way, that I just didn't deserve happiness. I had created this in my life. And so whatever came my way, I deserved. And that, that takes a long time to, even after I had married and had a beautiful family, I never felt worthy enough. And I will also have what I call the imposter. And I think this is a term psychologists use, the imposter syndrome, right, where I knew that if people really knew me and really knew about my past, they wouldn't like me and they would judge me. And so that was the other reason to keep this secret for 27 years, is I didn't want the illusion that people had of me, even though it was who I really was. I was this good person and I was doing wonderful things with my family. I would volunteer. I worked at Children's Hospital as a nurse. On the outside, I was a good person, but in the inside, I didn't feel like I was that good person. I always felt like I had to prove myself. And I always knew that if anyone knew about my past, they would feel differently about me.
Right. How did the abuse in the church impact your relationship with God?
It destroyed it in many ways. My spiritual life was taken away from me. It contaminated everything about my spiritual life. I couldn't walk into a church without getting a knot in my stomach. I didn't want to ever be alone with a pastor again. I took my kids to church because I wanted them to have that experience, but I couldn't engage in any way. And it was always a struggle for me to go when I did. But I put on that face and I struggled through it because I wanted to look like I had a normal life. And a normal life in my circle of friends was, you go to church, take your kids to church. So that's what I did. But it was very difficult for me. My spiritual life, 27 years, I never prayed. My children never had a bedtime prayer with their mother, which breaks my heart. But I did the best I could with the baggage that I was carrying. It was very, very difficult. And to this day, my relationship with God is back, but I have trouble still with church. He really destroyed that part for me. And I understand now when I go to church, if I have those feelings, I understand why I have them and they're not as intense, because before I just knotted up and I just accepted it. Now I understand why I have those feelings. So it makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, now you're safe.
Yes, exactly. And in my trauma brain doesn't overtake my logical brain that says, this is not how everyone is in the church. And I think have a little more attuned to any red flag that might appear. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I feel safer for that reason. I'm not as naive and gullible.
And well, remember, teenagers are supposed to be naive and
yes.
gullible, right?
Yes. But we think we know everything. That's part of the problem too.
Yeah.
And which is one of the things he would say to me many times. He'd say, I have to know that you're mature enough to handle this. Whenever I would get to a point where I was feeling guilty or I was not happy, he'd say, I have to know you're mature enough to handle this. You know, so
he knew exactly what to say.
He did. They do. Absolutely. All of them. They do. They got a playbook, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you a series of questions and how mm-hmm. the abuse impacted your life. If I ask you a question that it is not something you want to talk about, just please say that. It's okay. Fine. So how did the abuse impact your marriage?
Well, I think anytime you keep a secret from your spouse and you can't be truthful, that puts a divide there. I don't think he knew that, but I always struggled with that, knowing I wasn't being honest with him. And I, in my trauma brain, thinking, if I tell him, will he see me differently sexually? Will he think I lied to him all these years? Will he judge me? I knew that wasn't true and none of that would happen, but I couldn't trust it not to be true. So I it affected me in the way I responded to him, in the sense of trusting him. Sexually, it didn't affect me like it does many victims, because he was so loving, so caring, so kind. And we built a relationship. We dated 2 years before we were married. So I had built a trust up with him, and I did every now and then we may have a flashback, but I would say sexually, it didn't affect me as much as it can other victims. So I was very fortunate in that way. But I think for me, not being able to be honest with him was more of a burden for me.
Yeah, it sounds like you also got lucky in picking a spouse that wasn't abusive in any kind of way.
I did. Happens. Yes. Yeah. And I will say, after the abuse and had ended, I had not made good choices in who I was dating, mm-hmm. and had become somewhat promiscuous. Mm-hmm. All of that is very normal for victims. So I want victims out there to know that, you know, that adds into your low self-esteem when you're behaving that way, but that is part of post-traumatic abuse. So I am very, very fortunate that he came into my life, and I am very much aware that a lot of victims don't have that, but he was, when I did finally tell him, and I think most women can appreciate this, I did tell my girlfriends first before I told my husband. As fearful as I was of telling him, you know, he couldn't have been any more supportive and kind. And also in writing the book and allowing me to speak about the abuse, I one of my friends said, well, my husband would be supportive, but there's no way he would be very comfortable with me talking about the abuse and being as detailed as I have been. So I've been very fortunate that way. Yes. We have a great marriage. Yeah. We've been married for 43 years, I think.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. And I'm thinking probably being not allowed or given permission, but supported in your telling of your story is way more healing than having yes. to be worried about that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
How did the abuse impact your parenting?
Well, that's an interesting question, because many people say, well, weren't you afraid when your daughter went off to church camp or your daughter was at church? And I wasn't, because I, again, saw myself as getting the one bad apple in the barrel, that this didn't happen to anybody else, that this was so abnormal that a pastor would ever do this. So I never feared. Plus, I saw it again as an affair. And I just knew that she would never do something like that. She, you know, and I say that, you know, because I saw it as an affair, not abuse. So I didn't have that fear that most parents would have. However, I am watchful with my granddaughters. I watch them like hawks, and I have talked to them about safe touch and how to recognize, even though they're young. So my parenting skills that I should have had with my daughter, I moved to my granddaughters when it comes to worrying about abuse. I do remember when she turned 16, my daughter turned 16, looking at her and thinking how young she was and how young I was at that time. But I oddly enough, I never worried about her safety, because I think in part too, because I didn't want to acknowledge my own abuse. It was easier to put blinders on.
Yeah.
However, like I said, their spiritual life was not what I would have chosen for them had I been a different parent.
Sure. Yeah. I think what you shared about the difference between parenting your child and your grandchildren is one I've heard before as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you hadn't healed yet when you were a mom, and you had more healing. Yeah. But I'm wondering, do you recognize now anything that you did differently, whether negatively or positively, with your parenting that may have been related to the abuse?
Only in the sense, again, I go back to the spiritual part of it. It's interesting. I mean, I took them to church, but I never engaged in anything. My son was 3 years old, and he walked out and said, oh, we colored a picture of David and Goliath. Do you know about David and Goliath? And I, I froze. I could not even engage my 3-year-old in a Bible story. Yeah. So from that aspect of it, I parented in a different way than I would have. Now, I will tell a funny little story in the sense when I told my son about the abuse, and I told my children separately, I said to my son, you know, I feel guilty and bad that I didn't give you a spiritual life that I think you deserved. And I didn't engage you in church like I wanted to. And he said, oh, Mom, I think we went to church a lot. So I think my parenting, again, there wasn't a safety issue, which there should have been, but I don't think I could have done it with, like, as you said earlier, I wasn't healed. I wasn't in a place to discuss it because it would have been too close to talking about my own abuse. And I certainly wasn't ready to do that with my children at those ages.
Right. But were you able to be a warm, nurturing mom?
Yes. That I was. I mean, I think we all look back and think, oh, I remember the time I yelled and I wish I hadn't said that or done that. But I did try to be a warm and kind, loving mother, and their father was the same way. So they did have a good, happy home life, I think. I'm very fortunate. Many victims don't come out on the other side. So many of them end up in broken relationships. They turn to drug and alcohol to numb the pain. And, you know, I was very fortunate in that I was able to not fall into those traps. Like I said, in the early on, yeah, I could have fallen and gone down a different path, but I didn't.
So there was no, I call it maladaptive in my field, maladaptive coping skills, like never too much shopping, overeating, not eating, restricting, gambling.
No, I really didn't. I mean, I guess my husband would argue whether I had over shopping or not, but I can't, other than I just walked around with a cloud over my head constantly. I always feared someone would find out about my past, always. And I would run into people from my former church and I would freeze because I'm thinking, oh, they know about me and they're going to tell someone. I always worried that my husband would find out. And so, you know, I didn't live a normal life in that sense, but I don't know that it was reflected in my life outside of that.
Okay. And did the abuse have any impact on your physical health, your physical well-being? Like, I hear the cloud, but did you have any medical problems, muscle tension?
Well, only when I had the triggers that would occur periodically. I vomited once. I mean, I didn't have any long-term effects that I could tell, but I had enough trigger factors throughout the years that physically I was sick, physically ill from them.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And so we've talked about how trauma impacts health, relationships, spirituality, parenting. What about your mental health? Depression, post-traumatic stress, anxiety.
Well, I think the post-traumatic stress came in with attending church and how I, you know, I got a knot in my stomach or I'd hear a song and I was in shopping one in Hobby Lobby, which they play spiritual music and religious music, and a song came on. And for whatever reason, that particular hymn sent me over the edge and I shoved the cart away and I ran out of the store crying. So I had those kinds of moments, which were long-term because they went for 27 years. I mean, they were so frequent that, you know, for 27 years. And for me, the trigger factors were, I handled them in a way that I said, okay, it happened. It's over. Put it back in this little part of my brain and lock the box until it comes out again. That's not healthy. So for me now, when these triggers happen, and they still do, I manage them. I understand why they come. I feel them. I let them come in and then I let them go. Because there's nothing I can do about those. They come unexpectedly and sometimes they're intense and sometimes they're a fleeting moment. I tell people when most people recall a memory, it's a thought and you think about it. When abuse victims who've been traumatized recall a memory, it's physical.
In the body, yeah.
We get anxious. Our heart races. We may throw up. We may have, you know, a moment where we can't even function, which has happened more than once to me. I mean, I was pouring iced tea for my husband one evening for dinner, and I was having this moment, and I poured 4 iced teas, and I didn't even realize that I had done it. I had lost a section of time because I was back 30 years ago.
Yeah. And I read tremor, tremor at times.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different symptoms. Okay. How did the abuse, and I recognize it, everybody's impacted differently. So there's no expectation on my part that it impacted every area of your life, although I know it can.
Right.
How did the abuse impact your education?
Well, I initially wanted to attend a different college than I eventually attended because my abuser didn't want me going away to college. He didn't want me. And I now look back and realize he couldn't lose control of me because he probably thought that if I were to leave and get away from him, I would eventually tell someone if I'm away from him. So I didn't get to go to the college that I wanted to go to. And then because I was in this mess of a state, I couldn't really concentrate on school. And I was going in and out. I would take a few courses, then I would stop. Part of that was financial, but a lot of it had to do with I was just not in a good place. And so it definitely affected my education and the path that I took. I ended up in nursing, which I loved, but I don't know that that's a path I would have chosen necessarily if I had taken the path that I wanted to take initially.
Do you think it would have been more like the seminary path? Because you were really devout at one point.
My goal in life at that point was to marry a minister and be a minister's wife and serve a church somewhere. That's what I thought would be ideal. I thought about, you know, teaching. But all of that was derailed by him. It was totally derailed by him. Mm-hmm. And again, it took away my choice, whether or not that's what I would have ended up doing, whether or not that's what I would have been happy doing. He took away my choice and what I chose. And so I resented that. I resented that he altered and changed my life.
Right.
It was more resentment. I was angry.
And the anger is very valid.
Oh, it's very, yes. Yeah. It's justifiable anger, but eventually I had to find a way to let go of that anger because I had to let go of the hope of a different outcome. There was never going to be any legal action. I had to accept that there would be no consequences for him. He continued on in ministry and he was still praised by the church. I had to understand and accept the fact that this was abuse, that he never cared for me. All of those things that I was angry about were not helping me because they weren't going to change. Nothing was going to change. And so I had to say, I have to let go of this. It took a long, long time to do that because I had a right to be angry, but that wasn't serving me in my healing process. And so I found a way to channel that anger into something that was positive. And I tell victims, look, I found a way to help other victims by counseling and by doing conferences and volunteering for the Hope of Survivors Ministry. You can channel that anger into a hobby, into your family, something that you find comfort and peace in. That's where you live your life. Because as long as I was holding on to the anger, he was still controlling me.
Absolutely.
He was still in my life every single day that I woke up hating him. He was still there. And the only way to let go of him was to let go of the anger. And I wanted to live, I deserved to live the life I was meant to live, not the one that was created by his abuse. And so that was my moment to say, I'm going to move forward. Now, doesn't mean there aren't moments that I still have anger. Doesn't mean that I still resent the fact that I can't do anything about this man being in ministry, but I don't let it control me like it once did. And the abuse will always be a part of my life, but it doesn't have to define my life.
Right.
And that's how I was able to manage and find peace with myself. So before our time runs out, let me say what I would like to say to victims.
Please.
So the first thing that victims need to understand, and it took me a long time to come to this point, what was done to you was not your fault. You were targeted and your vulnerabilities were exploited. And whether those vulnerabilities are your age, whether it's low self-esteem, prior abuse, dysfunctional, whatever it is, that person that you should have been able to trust, whether it's a church member, a family member, whoever, should have been able to trust them, they exploited you. So there was nothing you could have done to change that because they are manipulative and they groomed you to a point where you were not able to say no. Secondly, I say educate yourself. that was huge for me to be able to understand the terms grooming, manipulation, and gaslighting. Once I understood those techniques, I could clearly see how they were used on me to manipulate and control me and get me to a point where I couldn't say no. I also say that you need to tell someone. And that's coming from someone who took 27 years to finally tell someone. So I understand how hard it is to tell someone that you're being abused or you have been abused. If you've been abused in the church, I would recommend going outside of the church to tell someone. But you need to find someone to tell. And you tell your story till someone does believe you and cares about you and doesn't judge you. I would also suggest a support group. That was very instrumental in my healing to find a support group. I'm a Protestant, but I joined the SNAP group, which is the Survivors Network Against Abusive Priests. They were very generous in allowing me to be a part of their group. I always joke that I was their token Protestant. and then, you know, finally, if you can get counseling, I highly recommend that. And certainly what you're doing is, you know, I applaud you for doing what you're doing and the work that you do, because we need a safe place. And victims can find that. And you can find that, I think, through a counselor, a good counselor. So all of those things were helpful to me, and hopefully they would be helpful to other victims.
Clearly you've given this talk before, because you listed all the things that were super helpful in your healing journey.
Yes, they were.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, it's a long journey, and it's not an end. There is no end to healing. You won't get to a stopping point, but you can heal, and there is hope in that healing. And I want victims to know that. I want to know there's hope.
Yes. And other than your book and the service-driven work you do, like with the Senate and so forth, how can a victim reach you if they want to connect with you? Do you offer any coaching services at this point?
I share my story. I'm not a licensed counselor, so I want to be very careful that people understand that I'm not a counselor. But what I've learned through the years is that sharing our stories is the most powerful thing we can do for each other sometimes. And one story may resonate with another victim, and my story might resonate with a different victim. And so sharing our stories can be very powerful. I had thought over the years, you know, what if while I was being abused, I had heard someone else's story of abuse? Maybe it would have given me the courage to come forward. Maybe it would have helped me to understand that I wasn't the only one that this was happening to. But they can reach me. I'm happy to talk. And I have a website. It's just my name. So it's Sandy Phillips Kirkham, and it's Phillips. Kirkham. And my book's on Amazon. So if you Google, Let Me Pray Upon, I know you had a hard time seeing, but there's the book. So it's Let Me Pray Upon. You can get that on Amazon or my website. I also have a Facebook page. If you check out my Facebook page, and both of those have, I think, a lot of good information, educational wise, it could maybe help victims and anyone who's interested in understanding this topic a little bit better. There's also a web page called Advocate Web, and they're very good with some information for abuse. And in the back of my book, I list some of these websites and other resources that I think would be helpful to victims.
And do you have another favorite book on the subject matter?
I do. And one of them is called Broken and Beautiful. And one of my favorites, and that's by Kristen Chalmers and Eileen Peters. The other one is called Healing from Hidden Abuse, A Journey Through Stages of Recovery from Psychological Abuse. And that's Shannon Thomas. She's a licensed therapist. I believe she also has a web page. Both of those books are very good. And then I'll give one more. This one would be great for victims who want to read other survivor stories. It's called Victim to Survivors, Women Recovering from Clergy Abuse. And it's basically just stories of different kinds of abuse that women have gone through. And I found that to be very helpful. Again, I would encourage the education part of healing. It's huge. It's massive. So, you know, read all you can, Google everything you can, and it will bring you to a closer point of understanding. And once you understand, what was done to you, not what just happened to you, but was done to you, it can begin that journey of healing for them.
Absolutely. Yes. So I have a support group, a group membership. So we're going to be highlighting your book this month. September, the month of September. Mm-hmm. By the time this airs in October, more people will know about it through my social media. So mm-hmm. I'm really thrilled that you wrote it. And my other question is, are you going to write another book?
I've been asked that. I'm not a writer by trade, and I never thought about writing. I joke that my sophomore English teacher is turning over in her grave at the thought that I wrote a book, but I don't know. I might. I don't know. I haven't, you know, it was a difficult thing to do, and it was very time consuming, and I don't know. I might. It's just never know. I didn't think I'd write one, so maybe I'll write two.
Yeah, I think sometimes there's no pressure, of course.
Right.
Your life will be beautiful whatever you decide to do. But sequels sometimes are the coming out on the other end, like the more
yes.
hope.
Yes.
Yeah. And you probably have some of that towards the end of this.
I do. And I tell people, one of the readers said to me, oh my gosh, when I was reading your book, all I could think of was that poor girl. And then I got to the second half of the book and I was like, you go, girl. So
good.
there is some good ending to it.
Good. Sandy, it's been an honor to have you on here today. And I'm really appreciative of telling your story. I agree. It's one of the very best ways to have a purpose in helping others. You know, it's an amazing thing that you're doing for people. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed this. It's been a great interview, and I appreciate all the work that you do as well.
Thank you for listening in today. Please join us next week, same day and time. Also, I would love for you to check out my website, healthrivedream.com.